very great pleasure and indeed a privilege to be able to welcome as our second keynote speaker, Professor Sir Michael Attia. He will be known to, I'm sure, almost all of you as one of the foremost mathematicians of his generation. Famously prolific, he has produced discoveries that have proved to be definitive points in the development of mathematics in the 20th century. His work in index theory, K-theory, gauge theory, just to mention a few examples, has been highly influential. He has received multiple honours, including two of the highest accolades in the subject, the Fields Medal and the Arbel Prize. And his mathematical heritage even extends on the personal level to a large number of students and descendants. A quick check on the Mathematical Genealogy Project revealed well over 300 descendants. And I know that amongst those are the current research supervisors of many people in this audience, and so including myself, in fact. I'm sure we will feel very proud at the end of our PhD labours to count ourselves among such a distinguished family tree. Professor Attia has very kindly agreed to come and talk about his career in the subject, which has been very long and distinguished, under the title of A Panoramic View of Mathematics. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're supposed to wait till the end for your applause. In giving the abstract of this talk title, I compared mathematics with climbing a mountain. There's all the hard slog to get to the top, and then there's the great view when you get there. And so I'm going to divide this talk roughly along those two halves. First, the way up, and then what do you see when you get there. And because coming back here to Cambridge and seeing all these young faces in front of me, it reminds me, of course, of what I was like when I was a student over 50 years ago. It's bound to be a lot of nostalgia and in this talk, and I'm going to give a lot of personal reminiscences of what it was like and who influenced me and so on. That's a certain amount of personal recollections. Now, when I was undergraduate, I'll start there. I know you're past that stage now. When I was undergraduate, the thing was very clear at Cambridge at the time was the tremendous competition. There were all these clever people from school all came in. All of them thought they were going to be Newton, and it was tough competition. But actually, it wasn't nearly as tough as it had been in the 19th century. In those days, when there were people competed to be senior angler, that was a real triumph. And if you became senior angler, the church bells rang in your honor, and you became famous, and so on and so forth. And there's a famous example of this. My slides now should work. There was young William Thomson, famous later as Lord Kelvin, who came down from Glasgow with a tremendous reputation in front of him. And one of the things he came down to be was to be senior angler. So when the results of the examination were to be announced, they read out to those days in Senate House in order of merit, and Thomson said, told his valet, in those days people had valets, go and tell me who came second. So his valet went and came back, and he said, who was second? He said, you were, sir. Well, it just shows that examinations aren't the only thing that matter in this world. Now, when I try to remember my lecturers, you'd like to think that if you're a lecturer, students will remember you for your brilliant lectures. Unfortunately, not many lecturers were brilliant lecturers in my time. There were just two, out of a large number. A lot of average ones, one or two poor ones. Now, the two lecturers whom I do remember, first of all, there was Albert Ingham, number theorist from King's, and he was a man with a very strong, loud voice and a lot of personality. He came in, he stood in, and the first thing he always did was take the chalk. In those days they used chalk, I don't know if they still use it now, and he went to the blackboard and he drew a vertical line down the middle of the blackboard so he could organize his talk into this first half and the second half, and he always did it that way. He was, really organized man, and he was a brilliant lecturer. Second man was Philip Hall, who was a great algebraist and a rather different personality. He was a rather modest, quiet man, mild, you might say, but very thoroughly organized, too. He would give lectures beautifully presented on the blackboard, every theorem carefully, precisely dotted and referenced, and all came from his head. But every now and again, he would say, let's see, by lemma 6.1, I think it's 6.1, he would go back, open his notes. Ah, yes, it was 6.1. Just to show you that he knew it all by heart. That how methodical he was. But they were brilliant lectures. He covered a wide range of topics, although technically he was talking about algebra. I first heard about Riemannian geometry from him. I first heard about cohomology from him. So I went to every lecture he ever gave. Another thing I remember about him is that he lectured between 12 and 1. Now, 1 o'clock, you know, is lunchtime. And so we would get a bit worried as lunch approached. And he lectured in a room without a clock, and he didn't have a watch. So at 10 to 1 every time, he would say, "What's the time, somebody?" And somebody would say, 10 to 1. Ah, just time to prove the theorem. Of course, he went on and on and on. Often. So those are the things you remember. There are also, of course, you remember eccentrics. And there are some eccentrics. One of my supervisors was a man called John Todd, a nice man, but very, very quiet. So quiet, when I used to go to him for supervisions, we'd go through the first part of the supervisions doing some examples. When we got to the end, there would be some time left over, and there would be a pause, and the pause would develop into a long silence. unbroken silence. And you have no idea how difficult it is to put up with 5-10 minutes of unbroken silence. So after that, I always went prepared with additional topics to raise in conversation. I liked him. He was a nice man, a very mild man. Now, another man who was an eccentric in a different way was very famous. Sorry, that's the wrong one. He's famous too, but we'll move on. was Paul Dirac, probably the greatest physicist after Einstein. And Dirac was a man also very quiet, but very for different reasons from Todd. He wasn't shy in that sense. He just thought words were important and anything you said should carry weight. So he didn't waste time on words which were not significant. So he was very difficult to get into conversation. Well, apparently one occasion he was dining in St. John's and a young lady sat next to him. And he said, "Professor Dirac, I've taken a bet that you'll say at least 3 words to me." He pointed to her and said, "You lose." So he was a man who was very precise. I went to his lectures because he was a famous man doing quantum mechanics. I wasn't really interested in quantum mechanics. I went to see this famous man, and I'm afraid the lectures were very boring because he'd written this book on quantum mechanics. He thought it was the best. He carefully chose his words. It was the best thing you could do, so how could you improve on it? So he just read from the book. And I'm afraid that makes a rather dull lecture. It's still a good book, but he was a remarkable man. Now, I wanted to go back now to mention the one I jumped over, William Hodge. Now, he was my supervisor, PhD supervisor. And I'll say more about that later. But he and Dirac were two leading figures in mathematics in Cambridge in those days. In those days, professors were rather rare beings. We only had 4 in the whole of mathematics. Now we have, I don't know how many. But we only had 2, 4, Dirac and Hodge were 2 of them. Oddly enough, they had very lot in common. They'd both been to Bristol University, they were connected with St. John's, and they were the 2 professors in the sort of out of the 4, and in fact, their work nowadays is seen as very close. Hodge studied what's called the Hodge theory, the Laplace equation, and Dirac studied what's called the Dirac equation, and nowadays, as part of theoretical physics, they're all part of a package. But in those days, that wasn't seen, and although they were close, I don't think they ever exchanged any mathematical contact between. I never heard Hodge refer to Dirac in that sense. It was an enormous gap, and actually, I think I spent my entire life trying to bridge that gap. No. It's an interesting phenomenon. Now, besides being remembered for being a good, brilliant lecturer occasionally, or for being an eccentric, you may not want to be remembered for being eccentric, or you may be remembered for taking good jokes. Now, there are 2 ones that I remember, 2 lectures, and the first one was Salam. Salam was a famous Pakistani theoretical physicist, got the Nobel Prize. And he was a lecturer here when I was in Cambridge. And he had this story he liked to tell. He was a pious Muslim in the days before being a pious Muslim made you a terrorist. he was a pious Muslim, and he said this story. There were these 2 scientists who were friends, and they said they agreed that when the first of them would pass away, we'd make contact with the one behind on Earth and tell him what it was like up there. So eventually, in due course, one of them passed away, went upstairs, And a little while later, a message came back to the chap below, and the chap said, what's it like up there? He says, well, some good news, some bad news. Well, first the good news. What's the good news? Ah, oh, it's terrific. Up there here we have Einstein, Newton, they're giving seminars every week. We'll understand all about the universe. And so what about the bad news? He said, well, on the notice board last week, I saw you were to give a seminar here next week. Well, so that's the kind of joke you remember. There was this Herman Bondi, who was one of the many figures around working with Fred Hoyle and others on cosmology in my time. He was a good lecturer in the sense that he had many stories. But the one I remember was the one he said about the young man who gave his lecture on electromagnetism, and his wife, who wasn't a mathematician or a physicist, came to listen to the lecture of her husband. And after the lecture, he went up to say, yeah, well, dear, what did you think of my lecture? And she said to him, magnetic moment. What a name for a perfume. Yeah. So that sticks in my mind. So you remember the mathematicians who tell good stories as well. Now, let me move on from undergraduate to postgraduate. Now, the transition from being undergraduate to postgraduate is, I think, extremely difficult one. Certainly, I find it extremely difficult one because, at least here, when you're undergraduate, you're very carefully controlled. You have to go to lectures, you have to pass exams, you have supervisors. You know, you're told what to do. You can do it well or otherwise. When you become a graduate student, suddenly you're on your own, sink or swim. Now, maybe a little advice once a week, you go and see your supervisor, but you're really very much on your own. And that's a very difficult transition to make from being totally regimented and organized to being totally free. You know, what can you do? You sit in your chair and think. Well, after 24 hours, it gets a bit tiring. So it is actually a very difficult transition to make. I was told, by the way, that one student I had who came from the continent, from the Netherlands, he said that there they don't look after you so well as undergraduates, so the transition for Dutch students is easier. I think there's some... whether we should stop looking after our undergraduates so well, I don't know. In my second year, I think many of you here are possibly in your second year, I was really getting depressed, and I thought of giving up mathematics. You know, I wasn't really getting anything out. It was hard work, lonely business. And so just to prepare the ground for an exit or quite some variety, I attended a lot of lectures on other subjects. I went to lectures on archaeology and architecture, and they were great. They were very interesting, easy to understand. Unlike mathematics lectures, you can sit back, and you know, not bother to think. It's easy. Of course, it's true that I didn't do all the architectural drawings that the students did. I didn't do the digs that the archaeologists did. But it was really very, very... I thought, mathematics is a tough subject. Why do I say mathematics? Well, I got some prize and I stayed in. But it was a low point. And many of you may go through a low point. If you do, think of that you'll get around that point. I was told once by Serre, who was probably the greatest pure mathematician of our era, that he went through a similar experience when he was a second-year student. You know, and in a way, if you're good, or think you're good, you have high expectations. If you don't succeed in them, that makes you depressed. If you're not too good, you may not have such high expectations, so it's easier. The other thing I realized when I started research was that there's an outside world. Cambridge, and some of you, not all of you from Cambridge, but some, you know, may apply elsewhere, it's quite a small world, and sometimes tend to be a bit smug. They think everything happened in Cambridge, we had Newton and so on. And it's there is an outside world, and when you start doing research, you realize there are other places. I realized there were places like Paris and Princeton, and I would try to go into the library to get the latest news from Paris, what did they prove last week, and that sort of thing. Nowadays, of course, you don't need to do that. You sit on the internet, you're on your computer, you're flying jets around the world anyway. So, you know, news travels fast. In those days, it was different. You had to work to get your news. So you probably don't have that problem. You know already the world outside exists. Next thing that's important when you're a graduate student is your initial choice of supervisor. The supervisor is the person who launches you in a given direction. And you know, it's very important to get launched in the right direction. If you get off in the right direction, you make a good start, and you can develop further on. I was fortunate. I had to make a choice. You see, you usually have to make a choice. I wanted to do geometry. My undergraduate supervisor had been John Todd, who, despite his personality, was a very good mathematician, classical geometry. So that would be the natural thing for me to work with him. On the other hand, I had heard about Professor Hodge, who was a famous international reputation, but he did more modern things. I didn't know him so well. But weighing things up, I thought, well, perhaps it'd be better if I go and work with Professor Hodge. And it was the right choice. I made a fortunate decision. I was lucky. On the other hand, if you make a mistake, it's not irrevocable. You can change. I mean, it's possible to change. For example, one of my contemporaries was Frank Adams. He started off working with Betty Kovich, who was a very charismatic Russian professor we had here, and worked on very obscure problems of set theory and so on, analysis. But after the year, he decided that wasn't really what he wanted to do, and he changed. He moved into topology, and he became a very successful topologist. He had his little phase lag where he lost the year doing something else, but that's a small price to pay in the long run of a mathematical career. So you can change your field and change your supervisor. It's also possible to change in later life. Later life is a different story. You've worked in some field for 10, 15, 20 years, and you either want to change, either you get interested in something else, or your motivation changes, you want to move from pure mathematics to applied mathematics. So you make a change by some choice. And I remember once talking with Henry Whitehead, who was a professor of topology in Oxford. He was the nephew of the famous A.N. Whitehead, who was professor of philosophy here in Cambridge. And Whitehead was a very good topologist. He told me he had so many friends in the world of topology, all good friends in Princeton and everywhere else. It was a big community. And he really enjoyed this communal feeling of belonging to an international community of topologists. He said the nightmare he had was, suppose one day he woke up and he had a brilliant idea in some totally different field. For example, functional analysis, he mentioned. Well, he was a very jovial man. He liked his pint of beer, his cricket, but he was also at his serious side. And he seriously felt, if he felt he had to pursue functional analysis for mathematical reasons, he'd have to find new friends, leave his old friends, and go. And that would horrify him, and he had to give up all his old friends. And it was a sort of constant worry for him. Well, actually, in my case, I was more fortunate because I later on moved, my interest moved from geometry into physics, theoretical physics. Some people don't think they're much different these days. But anyway, I moved into theoretical physics, and I didn't do it by conscious choice. I simply found things moving in my direction. I stayed put, and the physicist walked past the door. So I was able to keep all my old friends as well as make new friends. So I got around this sort of terrible Whitehead dilemma. How dumping your old friends when you move into new circles. So I was really very fortunate in that. And then when you finish your PhD, hopefully in a year or two, most of you will have moved on, finish your PhD, then you will have to go somewhere else. And I would recommend going somewhere else. Don't stay around too long where you've been because you want to get new things. So I left after my PhD, after being in Cambridge for 6 years as well. I went to Princeton to the famous... That was Sarah. I don't know about my story, Sarah. That was Henry Whitehead. Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, which is a mecca for people in mathematics and theoretical physics, where Einstein was, where von Neumann was. So it was the place to be in the eyes of people in mathematics and in theoretical physics as well. And there I made a lot of new friends, learned a lot of new things, and formed friendships with people which lasted my life, and many of whom I collaborated with, and I'll show you them later on. So by going to a new institution, you get a second boost. The first one, you chose a supervisor that carried you through your PhD. Then you need another boost to launch you into the higher world outside and get new ideas for further development. You don't always just going on adding lemons to your PhD thesis. That's not the way you want to progress. Now, when I was at the Institute, the director at the time was a very famous Robert Oppenheimer, physicist who was the man in charge of the atomic bomb project in Los Alamos during the war. When I went after the war, he was director of the Institute for Advanced Study, but he had a very hard time. This was the era of the McCarthy investigations, and he was accused of, although he helped the Americans win the war building the bomb, he was thought to be too friendly to the Russians or something like that. And he had a very tough time as director. Now, the people I got to know at the Institute of Advanced Study, made friends with and worked with half my life, I'll pick out several here. First, there's my friend Fritz Hitzelbrock from Germany, who was a major figure in German mathematics for a long period, and he was a young man there, and we got to know each other. And ever since, I've written dozens of papers with him. I used to go to Bonn every year for 20-odd years. So that you make friendships at that stage very easily, as you do when you're an undergraduate, but this time they're related to your future work, and they have an impact, especially if people come from different countries, you go abroad. So that was part of it. Then there was my Rao Bot, who died a few years ago, a very also charismatic Hungarian mathematician from Central Europe, but then at Harvard. And he was one of my greatest friends and collaborators. And then finally, my colleague is Singer, with whom I shared the Arbel Prize a few years back. So all of these I met that one or 2 years I spent in Princeton. Now let me move on a little bit from I've gone through the stage of being an undergraduate, PhD student, going further afield, being launched into the world. And now you start real life. So let me try to describe. let me just say, memory I have very clearly is when I was, I'm not sure exactly what stage it was, but when I was beginning to do research in some way, I had the feeling I didn't quite know, I felt like a man almost drowning. I was struggling with the waves, I couldn't see where I was going, there were lots of things around, I just didn't see how things fit into place. And it wasn't until some stage later on, I suddenly emerged from the waves, I could look around, I could see the sea, and I knew where I was, I knew how things fitted together. Began to get a sort of perspective. Early stages, you don't get perspective. You're seeing things at ground level, problems, solutions, and you don't have any picture of how all this integrates together. Until you've got that, you can't sort of impose any kind of order on it. You can't see where to go next. So there's a crucial stage when you, I like to say, you emerge from beneath the waves to see above what's happening. Now, try some description of what I might call the mathematical landscape. Mathematics have many different areas. At any given time, lots of things are being done. And when you arrive on the mathematical scene at a certain moment in time, people tend to think, well, it was always like that. There were always these areas in the past, and I'm just carrying on. But in fact, that's a misconception. Things change. Mathematics evolves. Areas come and go. In particular, different areas have different periods of breakthrough. Some areas coast along for a long time, 50 years or more, and then suddenly a brand new idea breaks through, and the subject changes forever. Those things, those breakthroughs are unpredictable. You can't tell when they're going to happen. If they happen at the right moment for you, you're in luck. You can swim with the tide, surf the wave. You can get in at the beginning of the action, and then it'll carry you forward. But it's very important for it to be timed right. If you're too early, you may spend 10 years slugging away, only for the breakthrough to appear later on and show that all you did was relatively trivial. Or you arrive too late. And by the time you arrive on the scene, the thing has swept through, and all that's left is the little bits and pieces left over. So you've got to choose it right. You've got to be born in the right year. and not much control do you have over that, but I was lucky. When I started doing my research, there were great things developing on the frontier between algebraic geometry and topology, and it was a very exciting period, and I was able to be in early stages of that, and that helped me to go along for quite a long time. Now, since you can't control the date of your birth, you have to do other things, and so one bit of advice I give is that try to maintain a wide range of interests. So you keep under review. You may be working somewhere, but keep under review as much as you can elsewhere. So if suddenly something takes off over there, you can perhaps move sideways and join the front line. So if you only work in one field, the chances of hitting that particular jackpot, that particular moment, are zero, or very, very small. If you work on a wide front, you have a non-zero chance of being where the action is at a given moment. So keep a broad front. And that's the best thing you can do if you can't be born in the right year. Secondly, like I said, talking about the unity of mathematics. Mathematics is a wide range of fields. Different techniques, different applications, different motivations, all sorts of divisions, subject matter, and traditionally, mathematics is divided up. As things get more specialized, they get even more specialized. You have departments, you have sub-departments, you have examinations, increasing diversity on different fields. So everything seems to be going one way. You know, more and more specialization, more and more diversification. You think of a mathematical science as spreading out in all possible directions. And if it does, it diverges. And people over here don't talk to people over there. But that's actually a mistaken view. It's the wrong picture. Mathematics is one in which different things do evolve and then interact again later on. It's a tangle. It's not a strictly ordered division by rigid barriers. And if you introduce rigid barriers for a given time, it actually stops progress. Progress comes because you want to maintain flexibility across the board. Mathematics is seen as a unity, even though it's enormously diverse. Unexpected things can happen in one field that influence another one, and we have to allow that to happen. Now, you can see that happening, for example, in Cambridge, which I was. In the old days, there was one department of mathematics. But then, for various reasons, partly personalities, partly expansion, the department split into two. They have these unappealing acronyms, one of which is unpronounceable, and the other of which doesn't sound very encouraging. But ironically, after the division was fossilized for a while, it was realized that the theoretical physicists who were put in the one department are really much closer to the geometers who are in another department. So rigid barriers are a bad thing. And I'm glad to say that when this new development took place here, and all the, but then such divisions are no longer so pertinent. Although there are two departments, there's plenty of opportunity for crossing the boundaries there. Another field, of course, which illustrates this is the relationship between logic and computer science. In the old days, if you were asked to put mathematics down at the spectrum of mathematics, you would say, well, on the extreme left, or whatever it is, there would be things like logic and the foundations of mathematics. You would go through algebra, analysis, number theory, applied mathematics. That would be your view of the spectrum of mathematics. Well, computer science is over here, and logic was over there, and they joined again. So however far apart things may appear to be, there's still possibility for them to have very fruitful interaction. Another example that's very familiar is called number theory. Number theory, prime numbers and so on, seems to be on the extreme end of pure mathematical theory, and cryptography. Secret codes and on are, well, you're not supposed to know where they are, but they're certainly not thought of as in pure mathematics, and now they are. I'm not letting into any secrets, but number theory started, just like a few years back, people with PhDs in logic were being snapped up by computer companies. Nowadays, people with PhDs in number theory are being snapped up by you-know-who. And of course, this is ironical because G.H. Hardy, the great mathematician before my time, a number theorist and analyst, he was, amongst other things, he was a pacifist. And he gloried in the fact that the kind of mathematics he did, number theory, was no use at all. And he really took great pride in that. What he meant by no use at all, it meant it couldn't be used to kill people, you see, in war. Well, unfortunately now, number theory is being used. I don't know exactly what it's used for, but it's going in that direction. So he will be turning in his grave. But in the relationship between mathematicians and cryptography, it's actually quite old, not just the modern one. One of my predecessors as professor of geometry in Oxford was a chap called John Wallis. Wallis spelled with an I-S, not the Scottish way. Some of you may know he has a famous formula for pi. And he was a great mathematician of his period. And that period coincided with the English Civil War. And during the Civil War, one side would win and then another side. It went on for quite a long time. And Wallis was much in demand for coding theory. He would describe codes which you could transmit secret messages without the other people finding out, or you could decode the messages the other people were doing. And he worked for both sides, depending who was winning. I mean, when one side was winning, they didn't capture him and put him in the tower. On the contrary, they took him over and made use of him. So this relationship between cryptography and mathematics is actually quite old. Now, if I look across the board in mathematics, this is the view from the top now, you can ask, looking back over the mathematics of the last century, what are the highlights? Well, no, what's happened? Well, no, big stuff. I think if I had to single out one idea in the whole of that period, which had a remarkable impact right across the board, is the idea of the soliton. Solitons are things which emerged, well, but the word soliton refers to officially a solitary wave solution of a differential equation, but it has many, many more connotations. It's something which behaves like a wave. It's a wave that behaves like a particle. It keeps its entity together under collisions and things like that. And they were discovered originally in numerical calculations on early computers by people like Neumann and so on. But then they spread, and they turn out there are models important in fluid mechanics, in fiber optics, in differential equation theory, where they constitute a class of what's called integrable differential equations, the equations you can solve. There's a very beautiful mathematical theory of them related to Lie groups, and they also turn up in physics in relation to things like black holes. And so these are thought of as like particles. Well, there's an enormous spread for an idea to take across, and it has led to links between all these different fields, which I find really, very encouraging. And I think it was the sort of biggest single event in the mathematical vista of the last century. And it's still going on. And it was, again, unexpected. I mean, nobody predicted it was going to happen. And even when it happened, it wasn't quite sure why it was there, what its reasons were. We now begin to understand a little more what solitons are. Of course, nothing in mathematics comes without a background. When you say, and I say it's unexpected, I don't mean that it grew out of nothing. There are rudiments, there are roots, you can trace them back. But there's a long way to go from the roots to the plants growing above soil. So solitons appeared with a big bang when they appeared, even though you can point to things happening earlier on which were the beginnings of soliton theory. And if you ask generally in mathematics, and this mathematics includes theoretical physics, what are the big themes that have emerged in the 20th century? I mean, I don't mean a topic like a soliton, but themes. I would suggest two. One is topology, the other is symmetry or group theory. And because both of these are unifying points of view that enable you to look at a lot of complicated things simplified in certain ways. Topology, which originated back in the work of Riemann, Poincaré, and so on, is a way of getting qualitative information when quantitative information is too difficult to get. But you can't find exact solutions of equations, but you can deduce things about their properties by topology, by allowing variation of the coefficients and seeing what happens and so on. So topology was a natural thing to emerge when life got too difficult for the classical mathematicians who went along solving problems explicitly by hand. And it grew in the 20th century from a sort of fledgling organization to something which had repercussions and influence across the whole board, into applied mathematics, into theoretical physics, everywhere. Symmetry, essentially the theory of group theory, which emerged early on, work of Abel and Galois, and then in the 19th century, the work of Sophus Lie on continuous groups, in the 20th century became, again, the dominant theme. It was employed in mathematics and theoretical physics everywhere because, basically, if you've got a situation which is highly symmetrical, naively speaking, instead of having 100 variables, you can use the symmetry to remove most of them and get left with a few. So it enabled you to handle complicated problems which have some sort of degree of symmetry by exploiting that symmetry. And therefore, the theory of the symmetry is essential in order to make use of that story. That underlies an enormous range of mathematics, and in number theory, in algebraic geometry, in topology, in differential equations, in theoretical physics. And so those are the two, I think, big themes there may be others, but the ones I pick out in 20th century. And solitons fit in the middle. That they belong to both those. Solitons have a topological character, and they also have a group character. So they are sort of a child of those two parents, in a way. Well, that's sort of like a description of mathematical landscape as I see it from up there. Let me turn now to what I call the philosophical view, the point of view. As a mathematician, I've always tried to take an interest not in abstract philosophy, but in, you know, trying to understand what it is we do in mathematics. Why do we do mathematics? And that sort of thing. And the first thing I'd like to point out to is that there are two things in mathematics which play an important role in an abstract way. One is beauty and one is truth. And Hermann Weyl, great mathematician, was asked, he said, in my lifetime I had two aims in life. One was a search after beauty, the other was a search after truth. And he said, if in doubt, I chose beauty. and this is always regarded as a very paradoxical attitude for a mathematician to take. We are in the business of proving theorems, getting truths. Beauty may be a luxury, but surely you can't prefer beauty to truth. Well, I've argued at times that Bert Weil was right, and you can give examples, understand what he meant. But you can put it this way, that beauty, whatever it is subjective. You know, if I think something is beautiful, you can't argue with me. You may disagree, but taste is personal. So if you think something is beautiful and that inspires you to work on it, who drives you on, that's your motivation. Without motivation, you get nowhere. Truth, on the other hand, is impersonal, objective, so you might think superior. But we never know what truth is. You know, we know what beauty is, we feel it. But truth is something we're looking for. We're searching for it. We'll be wrong. We may have partial truth. So truth is never known. It's always an aspiration. Beauty is known. That's why in some things, as a working mathematician, you want to know where you go. If beauty tells you to go this way, and the truth seems to go that way, don't trust the truth. It may be misleading you. Follow your instinct. And that, I think, is what Weil meant. And a good example of that is actually provided in one of Weil's most famous papers himself. After Einstein developed his theory of general relativity, in which gravitation is replaced by geometry, the obvious question was, what do you do with electromagnetism? And Weil was the first person who saw how the mathematical framework of Maxwell's equations could be viewed in very close relationship to Einstein's general relativity. And so he wrote this paper about it, and the paper was sent to a referee. The referee was Einstein. And Einstein was very impressed with this. He said it's a very beautiful piece of mathematics. Unfortunately, it totally contradicts physical experience, because if it was true, things like the proton would not have the same mass, whatever their plasticity was, and so on and so forth. So it conflicts with physics. So you think, well, a good editor of the journal would write back and say, I'm sorry, our referee, say we should decline your paper. But the referee was a very tolerant chap, and Weil was very persistent. So Weil's paper was published, despite this damning review by Einstein. But Einstein's report was in the appendix. So we get this very paper, beautiful paper by Weil, and in the appendix, Einstein pointing out the little difficulty there is in physics. Well, that's not the end of the story. Some years later on, with the development of quantum mechanics, some other physicists came along and said, ah, Weil's theory could be just changed. You put in an I somewhere, and you turn what's called a length into a phase. No, Einstein's objections disappear. Weil's theory works. It's taken over. It's the foundation of what I call gauge theory, the foundation of all modern physics. So it was a very beautiful example of where the beauty was in the equations and the idea. The technicality that it didn't quite fit was sorted out later on. Truth wasn't what it seemed. So Weil was right. And I say the editor of the journal was right to publish this paper. If he hadn't done, physics would have been held back a long time. Second question I asked is, why do we do mathematics? Well, I think there are many, many answers to this, as many as there are people in this room. Why do you do mathematics? Fundamentally, I think we do mathematics because we enjoy doing mathematics. We like, if you work on mathematics and you solve a hard problem, you get a kind of satisfaction that is really powerful. So we enjoy doing mathematics, and that's really our motivation. Of course, we may also want to do something useful in the world. We may want to apply our mathematics to outside that, maybe also motivation. There are many motivations. Although I have to say that my friend Raoul Bott tells this lovely story when he was not finishing at McGill University, where he was. He thought once he wanted to do medicine. So he went to see the dean of medicine, and he sat there, and the chap asked him a lot of questions and about why he wanted to do medicine. And at the end he said, is it that you want to do medicine because you want to do good in the world? If so, you make the worst doctors. So you have to have different, your motivation has to come rather different. And I think most people, our motivation is we like doing mathematics, and so we do it. In other words, we're following the beauty argument. If we find things attractive, we do it. Now, that's why an individual does mathematics. But then why, this is a bigger question, why should society pay for you to do that? So it doesn't pay poets, they have to earn their living some other way by living in a garret. It doesn't pay musicians unless they have rock bands. So society pays for a variety of reasons, okay? It's because mathematics as a whole is useful, underpins science, because we need math teachers, we need school. There's a whole range of practical outcomes which society pays for. It doesn't pay for you to do your research and enjoy your daydream, except insofar as you can point out the long-term benefits of research and so on. But there's no contradiction, really, between the two. The personal motivation, which is to chase beauty and do it because you enjoy it, and the society's need for mathematics to be developed. You can't force mathematicians to do things they don't like. You won't get good with mathematics. If you allow them to play around with their mathematics, they will do things which, in the long run, are useful. And that's the best way you balance the needs of society with the motivation of the individual. And then there is the associated with the role of teaching. You're paid in university partly because you teach students. And this teaching of students plays an important role, not only socially, but because it provides diversity for the people. If you're doing research all the time, it's hard work. You know, taking time off to talk to students is relaxation. It provides contact between generations. And in university, the function is, of course, to not only to carry forward mathematics, but to research-wise, but to transmit it from one person to another, from one generation to another one. And this applies, and so I use the word teaching here in broad sense. It refers to teaching undergraduates, teaching at school, teaching postgraduates, teaching postdocs, teaching your colleagues. So all communication of passing on information as it advances is a form of teaching, and it's all an integral part of the experience of a mathematician. And lastly, there is this link between theory and experiment you get in science. And nowadays also you have to add the computer dimension, simulation, theory, experiment, and computer. And this delicate mixture or balance between all these three is an important part of the development of the subject. And it influences people in different degrees, depending on what they do, but it's all an important part of the total balance that makes the mathematical world. Now, I think I've probably skipped a few of my beautiful pictures here, but let's see, where are we? All my pictures are people, you know, with one exception. This was Hardy, whom I told you about. Actually, pictures of Hardy are rare. He didn't like taking his photograph taken. This is one of only about two that exist. Apparently, when he went into a room and there was a mirror, the first thing he did was to put a coat over the mirror so he couldn't see himself. And this is Hermann Weyl, who I say is my mathematical hero, and whose quotation I gave you. Now, next thing, let's turn to the variety of mathematics. Mathematics has a wide range of fields. Also, you might talk about the difference between doing mathematics on a broad front, breadth, and depth. Some people spend their entire life digging deeper and deeper, looking for that gold mine. And some people skim the surface and try to pick up as many pebbles on the beach, as Newton said, that they can. So the different kinds of mathematics, and that's a good thing. We don't want all people to be digging in the same place. This is seen in the, if you look at the literature, people write, the collected works of Riemann occupy one volume. But each of those papers in that volume initiated a whole new area of mathematical physics, you know, Riemannian geometry, the theta function. So, I mean, very, very fertile and productive, even though not so voluminous. On the other hand, Euler, the extreme opposite. I think they're still trying to publish all his collected volumes. There have got about 25 or 30, and they're still going on. I mean, he stopped publishing, but they're trying to organize them. He was an enormously prolific, and of high quality, too. I'm not trying to say he wasn't. But you can have Riemann and you can have Euler. You can do whichever one you prefer. If you're publishing a lot of papers, you can say, I'm Euler. If you're not publishing much, you can say, I'm Riemann. And if you want to get by with a very small number of publications, get your face on a stamp, you can be Arbel, but in that case, you have to sacrifice yourself at the early young age. And you've got to get to work pretty fast. He died at the age of 28. Now, there are different people say there are different types of mathematicians. There are theory builders, people who like to build a great theory, and there are problem solvers who like to crack a hard nut. And there is some truth in that. There are different. I think the answer is not just a dichotomy, but it's a spectrum. There are people who are very happy with building theories and all the way to mixtures of theories and problems. The others who are really don't like theory at all, just like hard problem one after the other. You find extremes, but in general they're a mixture. But also the other thing to remember is there's a big relationship. A theory usually arises because somebody has solved the problem and another problem, and you begin to see a pattern and that you build up a collection of things which uniformly enable you to tackle all questions of that kind, and that becomes a theory. So a theory emerges as a kind of collective operation of solving separate problems, and eventually, if it's to justify itself, it must solve other problems very far removed from the ones you started with because of the overarching view of the theory. And conversely, so the theories and problems go together. Theories are designed to solve problems. Theories emerge from problem solving. But at any given stage, the problem solving may still be early on. The theory hasn't developed, or the theory may be very far advanced, and you can do many things with it. So don't regard them as alternatives. They are complementary. Although you may be yourself inclined to one end or the other of the spectrum. And that also reflects on the fact that mathematicians are people. And I like to show all these pictures to emphasize that mathematicians are people. Mathematics is not created, people sometimes think it was always there. Well, every bit of mathematics anywhere had to be created by somebody, a mathematician somewhere. And the same will be for the future. So mathematics is created by people, and the personality of people plays a role in their work. I mean, there are many different kinds of personalities. I know many mathematicians, and there are, as many different kinds of mathematicians as there are other people. There are solitary individuals, there are gregarious individuals, there are people who work late at night and those who work in the morning. There are people who work hard, those who don't work much at all, but have occasional inspiration. So there are all kinds, and it's essential that we have all kinds because different kinds of work do require different personalities. And the kind of works, you can be very solitary in your work, sit hard, think on your desk, or you can be very gregarious. You can talk to your colleague, you're always at the blackboard, exchange ideas, and I tend to be on that side, but occasionally you have to go back and think on your own. So you need a balance between individual hard thought and constant exchange of information with other people. And the advantage of that second part is it gives you some society. It gives you contact with other people. Entirely thinking on your own for years on end can drive you crackers. Unfortunately, literally true sometimes. So finally, I should come to some words of advice. Well, I've been giving advice as I've gone along, but let's summarize them. So the first bit of advice is believe in yourself and follow your gut instincts. Because you can't really work on things unless you believe in them. If somebody tells you to do something by force, you're not going to have the necessary drive to overcome all the obstacles on the way. So it has to be your own choice. And you must follow what you think is the direction you're going to be successful in, even if it turns out to be wrong. But you need a motivation, you need a driver, and that is coming from yourself. It can't come from outside, it can't be instilled into you by your teacher or your students. You have to be self-motivated. Secondly, be wary of bandwagons. Mathematics very often has large armies of people marching forward at the head of their theory, and it's easy to be swept up by this, and occasionally necessary to march in step with your fellow people, see what's going on. But don't do it uncritically. Be prepared to leave the bandwagon as necessary. Or don't join it if you think it's going the wrong way. So be wary of bandwagons. Don't disregard them, but be careful. Secondly, you should always aim in mathematics. Should always be to not just to get an answer, but to understand what's happening. Nowadays, people think, all the mathematics needs to do is you feed in a lot of numbers, you get them out of the computer at the other end, you print the answer. There's the answer. Well, an answer without any understanding is not mathematics, in my view. It may solve a problem in some sense, but doesn't it tell you why it's true? If it doesn't tell you why it's true, you can't solve the next problem. So you should always be asking why something works, and that leads you on to the next step. And without asking yourself questions, you don't make progress. So be curious. Next point is, I think, if you think of mathematics as being some kind of exploring a landscape, your new territory, you're going forward on a big road, your aim is some mountain in the distance. And there are also side roads, some side paths. Should you follow the side path or not? Well, I think my view would be that you should always go so far up a side path, if you're actually walking in the hills, you may want to go up that side path until you get to a viewpoint where you can see whether that's a good route or not. And if it is, you might go further. If it isn't, you come back. So similarly, if you have an idea, you're working on something, suddenly a sideline occurs to you. Should I explore that or not? It'll distract me from my main goal. Answer is, yes, be distracted. Follow it up. You never know. It might turn out to be more interesting than the original problem. Or it might shed light on the problem. But only so far. If you waste all your time following all sidetracks, you will get bogged down. So it's a delicate art you have to learn to balance the drive on the main theme and the pursuit of sidelines, which may turn out to be very productive. Without those sidelines, you will never get really fundamentally new ideas. They come from doing something unexpected. And related to that is the question that I say is, be prepared to consider crazy ideas, radical ideas. Radical ideas are things which look daft in the first instance. And you should be prepared to consider them. Doesn't follow that every crazy idea is a good one, but some crazy ideas are good ones, and you want to think carefully before discarding them entirely. And there's a famous story about Wolfgang Pauli, very famous physicist, Nobel Prize winner, who also had a very sharp wit, and he was a sharp tongue. And one man came to him once and explained an idea he had, and Pauli said, "That's a crazy idea, but it's not crazy enough. A really good idea has to be really crazy. You know, minor craziness is not good enough." And my last piece of advice is, don't always follow advice. Well, listen, but don't always follow it. And so, but of course, if my piece of advice is don't follow the advice, I'm in some sort of Bertrand Russell circular paradox. So I'm getting into deep waters there. Now, I was going to say a few comments about more general things. One of the most famous debates took place in physics, I suppose, in the last century, was the famous debate between Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein about the fundamental nature of physics and quantum mechanics. It was a long battle. Both sides fought very tenaciously. The general view is that Bohr won, Einstein had to withdraw, and Einstein spent the last years of his life pursuing a chimera of a unified field theory and so on. Poor old man, he'd lost his marbles. But Einstein was the greatest physicist of his time, no question. And so I tend to sympathize with Einstein. And I like to finish this quotation, apparently due to Zhou Enlai, the former Chinese foreign minister who spent many years in Paris, and he was asked what he thought the effects of the French Revolution had been. He said, "It's too early to say." And I think the truth of the Bohr-Einstein debate, it's still too early to say. Give us another 50 years or so. But finally, I'd like to connect mathematics up to the outside world. Mathematics is related to other fields, and also mathematicians move into other fields. Many talented mathematicians have gone elsewhere. And just to give you some examples, my own contact here, that's Niels Bohr and Einstein, who I just spoke of. And this is James Mackay, who was one of my contemporaries in Cambridge, a mathematician at the time, who left and went into the law, and ended up as Lord Chancellor of Great Britain. So you can't get higher than that. But with a good mathematical brain, move to another field and you'll be successful. When I was at Oxford, I had one time, amongst my former students, the three youngest professors in Oxford, who really moved into different fields. Here they are. First of us, Sir Walter Bodmer, very famous in genetics. Sir John Kingman, who was in probability theory, saying mathematics, and so on. And Sir James Merlis, who got the Nobel Prize for economics. If you find mathematics hard, or not interesting enough, and move into other fields, don't think of yourself as a failure. Think of yourself as a mathematician going on to great glory in other fields. Thank you. Well, first of all, let me tell you, my wife is mathematics, did a PhD in mathematics. How about that? It's a good start. And I think the best Well, my PhD students, the last three were all women. All went on to have distinguished careers. So, yes. I'm a child of my time. When I was around, there were very few women. And now there are many more. Looking around this room. Well. Actually, I just come back from the University of Cyprus. And when I was there, I gave a lecture. 3/4 of the audience were girls. So I commented to the university. It's very impressive. All the Cyprus, all, said, well, the boys all go to Athens. Well, you know, Archimedes in his bath, or sort of, you mean. there are a few occasions I remember. I remember once going for a walk in the woods with one of my colleagues. And by the time we came back from our walk, you know, we had inspiration. So walking is very good. I recommend walking. it keeps the brain alive. Actually, even in my room, my office, I don't sit at a desk. I walk usually up and down, up and down, up and down. Let's see. Well, you don't really remember single moments so much, but I think Poincaré said one of his best ideas got to him when he was getting off a bus. It's the unexpected, unusual context. Going for a walk, getting off a bus sometimes triggers something. Nobody knows where ideas come from, but random events can be triggered by unexpected things, not necessarily by a good lecture or what sort. Actually, by bad lecture, I should say that I did some of my best work in bad lectures. If you go to a seminar, it's a very bad seminar. After a while, you begin to think, gosh, this is terrible. It's got a nice result, but it must be a better proof. So I spent my time trying to find a better proof of the seminar because occasionally you would succeed, but you're spurred on by seeing something badly done if you look at something beautiful.
Thank you.